Welcome. In this episode, we are joined by Dr. Lucas Avagno, Associate Professor at Bilkent University, to talk about cities in Byzantium.
Hello, Luca. Welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure being here, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for accepting our invitation. It's really good to have you here. Before, you know, starting with the conversation, why don't you say a few things about yourself so our audience gets to know you?
Yeah, I'm with pleasure. I'm currently an associate professor in Byzantine studies at Bilkent University in Ankara, but my journey started from academic journey. Started from Venice, Italy, where I got my BA, and then I moved for my PhD, MPhil first, and PhD. Back then, you could still upgrade. Was the days when you could upgrade from MPhil to PhD at the University of Birmingham, Center of Byzantine, Ottoman, and Modern Greek Studies, where I pursue my PhD on the topic was Byzantine cities, with under the supervision of Chris Wickham and John Holden. And then when John Holden moved to Princeton the last year of my PhD with Richard White. And this is the link that we have with Gavril. So it's the link with them. It's the Birmingham, infamous Birmingham connection, if you allow me to say.
Indeed, yes.
And then after my PhD, I moved to Istanbul, where I got my postdoc at Danamed. And that's where my love story with Turkey, of the Eastern Mediterranean better, started. Because immediately after that, I got my first position at Eastern Mediterranean University in Cyprus, Northern Cyprus, actually. And from there, in Ankara in Bilkent. So that's my journey, in a sense, which I hope it will continue, but for the time being it stopped at Bilkent in Ankara.
But you know, I was wondering, and I'm sure Panos was wondering that too, why and how did you decide to start working on cities?
Well, there is one thing that I always said. I'm sure you agree, guys. Because in the end, I'm young enough. It doesn't look like. Thank God they don't see it on the podcast. They don't see the video. But I'm young enough to remember. The days when I was a student, and I think we were chatting with you guys before a bit. It's about the passion and the. And the influence because of the passion that the instructors have. So when I was doing my BA in Venice, at the University of Venice, Ca' Foscari, the first course I took was Byzantine history. And then I took Byzantine, because I really like the way that the professor back then, it was Professor Giorgio Rovignani, was a leading figure in Byzantine studies in Italy, the way he taught Byzantine history. Then I took Byzantine art history, and as a course. So one thing led to another, and in the Byzantine art history during that course, Professor Agnio Concina, was also start running an excavation in an area, in a city, called Civitas Nova Heracliana, which was a Byzantine completely newly founded city dated to the 7th century, obviously dedicated to Emperor Heraclius. And there is a lot of connections with the origins of Venice, because nowadays this city, which is buried and hasn't been fully excavated, it would never be most probably fully excavated, is on the countryside, not far away from Venice, something like 30 kilometers as the crow flies. Back in the 7th century was really in the lagoon. So basically it was a Venice before Venice, in a sense, up to a point. So he was trying to run an excavation then, and he brought us there to help him with the excavation. I mean, he set up a team and a lab to study the material which came up from this very, very small trench that he excavated, to be honest. I remember it was extremely, extremely, extremely small. And I mean, I started getting interest into the city, the way that a new city was born, it was founded, and so on and so forth. Then I decided to continue study with him under his supervision, in a sense. In Italy, it's a little bit different than in the UK or elsewhere. I think it's a little bit similar to what the university system in Greece, where you can, in the end, at the end of your studies, you can ask, right? I think Panos can confirm that. You can ask for a professor to supervise a BA, what is called BA thesis, in a sense, and which is propedeutical to the master and then to the PhD later on, obviously, with the master. So I asked if I could write a thesis on cities and on Byzantine cities. So he said, under his supervision, in light of the fact that we were excavating a Byzantine city, and he said yes. So he encouraged me to continue working on cities. So I remember that the BA thesis was about was a comparison between Civitas Nova Heracleana, obviously Nafplion in Greece, and if I'm not mistaken, what was the third one? Now I forgot about it. I thought it was Amastris in Anatolia. Well, in the end, that thesis turned into an SOP for the MPhil at the University of Birmingham, where Chris Wickham, where Professor Wickham was happy to in a sense embrace or help me developing this first idea stemming from my thesis. And basically, once I got in Birmingham, through Chris, courtesy of Chris and also of John Holden, were both having cities at the heart of their research, both of them. I mean, I arrived in Birmingham when Chris was writing Framing the Early Middle Ages and John was completing the first volume, or sparkly starting, pardon, the first volume of the Iconoclasm books, the sources one, the one on sources. But John had worked on cities before with Byzantium in the 7th century and so on and so forth. So that's how I came to city. And it boils down, in the end, it boils down to teachers, right? And what they do and the passion that they have. If they transmit that passion, if they make you part of something or make you feel part of something. I mean, the excavation back then, I'm sorry, I'm talking too much, you know. But that, I remember that excavation back then, I mean, it was like to us. I mean, there was a group of students, basically none of them continued and they went on. But for us was like, really, we felt like Indiana Jones discovering the origins of Venice. So, I mean, it was like, oh my God. And Professor Conchita, who passed away later on, was happy also to encourage us, to encourage this kind of enthusiasm with the lab and everything. So it was good days.
So in order to understand how a city was founded and maybe the motives or the ideology behind the creation of a city, can we talk about the difference maybe between Roman time or Byzantine time, if there is any?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, there is obviously a difference, and I think starting this journey from a newly founded city, in a sense, helped a lot. Because when I studied Civitas Nova Heracleana, which also, by the way, was included in the PhD thesis, I managed to have it as an appendix because there was a word limitation. I don't remember. We had to add it as an appendix or something like that in the end. Having starting from, as I said, this journey from a completely founded from scratch, newly founded city, which was also the capital of the Venice Ducate, okay, the Byzantine Venice Ducate. I mean, the story of the Byzantine Venice Ducate is pretty famous. Okay, it took off with the arrival of the Lombards and the separation of the Venezia. That was the the name of the region, actually the Venezia, because it was already plural, the clear separation of the Venezia Marittima, the maritime Venice, from the Venezia Terrestris, from the terrestrial Venice, in a sense, the former under control of the Byzantines and the second under control of the Lombards and later on part of the Kingdom of Italy and so on and so forth. So completely different trajectories between the two areas. The Venezia Marittima, obviously, the lagoon, okay, which were more extended than they are today, but more or less this is the landscape that we were facing. Well, in the Venezia Marittima, at some point, Byzantium decided to found a new city called Civitas Nova Heracleana. I mean, it's also his origins, trajectories are a little bit, shrouded in myth, because then Venice, when they Venice built its own, the myth as a city, because, I mean, this is what also city do. They like to dress up, okay, to use myths to change their past, to mold their past and to recreate their own past. Anyway, when we are dealing with this new city, I mean, completely found from scratch in the middle of a lagoon, I mean, you are dealing with an urban fabric and landscape which has nothing to do with what supposedly or could be there in the past. And there, I mean, I'm referring to, or I can quote, I can cite a book, which is, I think, a wonderful book called edited by Sunak Abatai and a few other colleagues, called Cities as Palimpsests. So this idea that cities are, right, sort of accumulation of layers, I mean, obviously having to do with, and I will return to that maybe later on, to function, to fabric, to landscape, to myth, to memories, and so on and so forth. Well, in this very case, you don't have any palimpsest. There was clearly something that it was virgin territory and they built the city. So that helps you a lot to try and understand and to try to come to grasp with the fact that this concept that you need necessarily a predecessor of a city to have a city itself could be deceiving sometimes. So, I mean, Panos, you are sitting in Thessaloniki, I mean, Gavrili sitting in Liverpool. There is not too much we can do with Liverpool. What can we do? But with Thessaloniki, which is a great city, there you are sitting on a palimpsest, you are on the top of, I mean, you know it better than me, I don't need to teach you anything. But there, when starting from scratch, you can fully grasp the fact that a city, the term city, I think, doesn't mean anything in a sense. We take it so many things for granted, because I mean we think that the city should mean something, or in our mind it meant something, and we are all, you and I mean all of us, in a sense, influenced by all the policies, right? The polis, it's the foundation of Western civilization, one the foundation of Western civilization, with all the amenities that the polis has. I mean, I don't need to list them. But here, I mean, you have something completely new, something completely different, a different way of even conceiving a city, of thinking of a city, which in a sense forces you to, as I was mentioning before, to deal with functions more than anything. So this idea that you are having a city to satisfy certain functions and satisfy them in a way that most probably, actually, for sure, certainly, in the past would have been satisfied and would have been materialized, in a sense, literally, I'm using materialized, or made them real, made up with matter, in a sense, in a completely different way. So, for instance, in Civitas Nova Heracleana, I mean, there was no stone being used. I mean, you are something that later on, Sauro Gelichi and Andrea Genti, among the others, have identified happening through excavation, through archaeology, in a place called Comacchio, which is another ancestor of Venice, which basically flourished in the 8th and 9th century, again, in the middle of the lagoon, taking advantage of the fact that Ravenna had fallen, And this place is completely built along the lines of northern Emporia, places like Hamburg, places like Quentovic, places like London, and so on and so forth, many others. So with Civitas Novara Kleene, you see these residential areas being built, or most probably being built with in wood. Okay, there are no stones. There is, because in the lagoons there are no stones, and I'm referring here to a 9th century will of a Byzantine, sorry, of a Venetian duke. Duke is a Byzantine title here, clearly, Justinianus Partichiacus, who basically in his will included stones. I said, I'm bequeathing stones. If you bequeath stones, it means the stones are not really so common to be found. So you have to satisfy certain function in a different way. And there you have, it's Civitas Novara Kleene, you had a mound, it had a church and a baptistery, which was the only, most probably one of the few buildings built entirely with stones. And obviously there you have all the idea of exalting certain functions, the place of the bishop, the place of the first duke, because that was the capital of the Venezia Marittima, the first capital, followed by Metamaucum and then Rialto. So in a nutshell, sorry, I talk once again too much. You are forced to face the reality of a city. And here, I think Nico Sivic is absolutely right. The reality, what a real Byzantine city is or was, in a sense, or one of the possible realities of Byzantine city. I hope I answer, Panos. If not...
No, that's fine, but I have so many questions. One of them has to do with Saloniki and the relationship with Constantinople. And in your book, you characterize them as Red Queens. So I have the opportunity to ask why this terminology, and maybe we can talk about the relationship, the special relationship between these two major cities in Eastern Mediterranean.
Once again, it's a great question. I mean, and you, how can I say, you you stress the fact that in my books, also in the previous one on Cyprus, I like to refer to my questionable and very bad taste in cinema, in this very case, is obviously Resident Evil. But I like cinema. I happen to teach also, I mean, the things that you do for a living. I was asked to teach history of cinema when I was in teaching in Northern Cyprus. So I did it I always like movies. But I like this kind of pop culture, in a sense. So the Red Queens is obviously, as I said, a reference to Resident Evil in previous, I mean, I have to tell to your audience that in previous articles and previous books, I refer to way better movies, like one recent article is called Cyprus and Its Sisters, really, I mean, referring to a movie of Woody Allen, so it's much better. But this one, the Red Queens is Resident Evil, because, I mean, I was playing and I was toying with this source, Western source, which refer to the cities in the West, okay, as cadavers, as corpses, in a sense, okay, because I mean, the Western Roman Empire fell, and it was the cities were completely destroyed. So these corpses, this idea that cities turn into zombies, like in Resident Evil, right? And the only ones to survive were the Red Queen, in the Red Queens, plural in this very case, and not singular like in the movie, is something that we need to overcome, in a sense. So this idea that the only, and I'm going back to Tsiviki's article here, the idea of having simply Constantinople or Thessaloniki as the Byzantine cities par excellence, and the others are basically corpses that moved from Polis to Castron. I mean, most probably return to this, and they shrunk, they lost importance, they lost, they depopulated, they simply shelter behind hastily built fortification and so on and so forth. Well, this idea should be challenged in a sense. It's true that, as you were mentioning, the link, I mean, the role of Constantinople as a capital and the role of Thessaloniki as the second city, the most important in the Aegean, the one which survived to the Slavic, Avar Slavic incursion, the one which developed the cult of San Demetrios, and so on and so forth. These two have caught a lot of attention. I'm not saying that this is wrong, but it's also deceiving, because we may tend to believe that this is what is left of what should really get our attention in archaeological terms. Well, it's also true that they produce a lot of literary sources, which in particular in the 7th and 8th century, we don't have. The Miracle of San Demetrius is one of the sources in question. But this, once again, if we think only of the Red Queens, I mean, you tend to believe that Byzantium had turned into that sort of last, those two cities were the last reduct of urbanism, and this is not the case. So my idea was to encourage to look beyond this idea that these two cities, which best, I mean, think represent the most important ones, were all the only representative of Byzantine urbanism, or what we can call Byzantine urbanism, and we should instead try to have a look at what's going on elsewhere, and even challenge certain preconception, which those cities help us to fuel, in a sense, because if you think of how cities were represented, I mean, if you think you know this thing way better than me, and I'm sure the audience is way, way familiar with this mosaic 10th century in the South Vestibule, Hagia Sophia, right? Constantine donating or showing or asking the Theotokos for protection to the city. The city is represented like a walled model. That's it, the walls and the Chalchi, right, represent the city, the gate, strong gates, bronze gates, and so on and so forth. If it's not the Chalchi, it's the Golden Gate. It doesn't change too much, at least not in iconographic terms, maybe in ideological terms, yes. Well, anyway, also this idea that, and those cities had huge fortification, like Thessaloniki, Panos, you know this better than me, and Constantinople, Gabriel most probably also know. I mean, these are huge fortifications, but those fortifications we tend to identify simply as a structure, infrastructure, which protects the city. I mean, at different meanings. Once again, the palimpsest, right? The palimpsest of meanings, the palimpsest of function, connotation, the way that, and this is another thing that I'm always encouraging, I would like to see more, much more study, the history from below, the way that the people, and this is Nikos Bakirtis has done a wonderful job on the fortification of Thessaloniki in this respect, exactly. The way that you see the fortification, the population interacting with the fortification, and not simply as, okay, they are protecting us, and this is true, but also a way, for instance, and Nikos has showed us the continuity of this function even in today's world, a way to advertise certain aspect of the city life, being that more obviously restorations, but also other events dotted, punctuated the city life, or a way to exalt, to, as I was saying before, right, to give importance visually and practically to certain areas hosting certain functions of the city. I think Christina Tsikonakis did a wonderful job in showing this in a place called Eleftherna in Crete, where basically you have these huge walls built in the late 7th century. And well, but those walls, yes, have a lot, I mean, protection, for sure, nobody's toning it down, but it's also, it has a lot to do with that area of the city which was included or encased by the walls, and there's a lot to do with the fact that that area was the place where the local bishop and the local administrators, the aristocrats, the elites, imperial or not, resided. And therefore, it's more to do about controlling the population that live outside the walls rather than protecting themselves from certain invasions, because that's also another myth, right? That's why the Red Queens, in a sense, we are sheltering from an invasion of zombies. Those zombies could be the Arabs, could be the Avar Slavs in the case of Thessaloniki. That's another layer, metaphorical layer that I would like to hint at. And that's why, in a sense, the Red Queens.
And I guess not only the people we protect, not only the city, not only from the people who live outside of it, but also from the people who cultivate the land, I guess, based on a feudalism system of the medieval world, right?
Well, you know better than me, Gabriel, that if we utter feudalism immediately, we get 3,000 hits, 600 hits on the part of the other side. What the heck are you... Feudalism in Byzantium, I mean, this is a very good, I mean, a very good point, because if you look at the city as Justiniana Prima, you see this thing in action, sorry, being this kind of way of devising or a way of building a certain urban environment, urban landscape, urban fabric, if you want, with what's called as zoning, right? If you have Justiniana Prima in mind, the map, the plan, you have an area, once again, encased by walls with this forum of circular, like in Constantinople, right? In Constantine Forum, you have the two portico streets intersecting exactly at the forum, the circular forum. You have the basilica, you have the palace of the local, of the prefect, if I'm not mistaken. Then as a first line of walls separating this area from the lower city, and then you had another part of the city which was dedicated with the second part as a residential function with other churches, basilicas, and so on and so forth, other amenities. And then you have a third part of the city where you have commercial, artisanal quarters, and even part of the city which is, which, as you said, the chora, in a sense, right? The chora, the countryside. And this is a very good way of interpreting the city. I think it's essential to see the city as a combination of the two. In a sense, nothing new under the sun, right? But we tend to think, okay, everything is happening behind the walls, behind closed doors. And the rest of the city is purely, I mean, either residential or, if we are lucky, with artisanal and commercial functions, and so purely parasitical up to a point, or partially productive sometimes. But, I mean, that's pretty much it. We don't have too much going on. I mean, this interaction between the city and the countryside is essential and should be taken into due consideration. Okay. I mean, true, those walls could act as a shelter for those peasants who were running away from the countryside if something happened. So there is the kind of protective thing, but they are also meant to keep those peasants away when there is something going on and they are not very happy, let's say, with the taxation, the level of taxation, that's what I was looking for, and the fiscal pressure, or if there is something going on. So there are tons of references to this, to the very fact that life in the city was happening outside the walls, that things were happening outside the walls. So you have to take both of them into consideration. I think, well, we'll most probably return to that later on, but I think one of the best examples of this is the city of Gortyn in Crete, where Enrico Zanini, among the others, Elisabetta Giorgi as well, have investigated the city, its trajectories, its development, the development of the urban structures, but above all, the infrastructures. But the way they look at the urban infrastructures, which is once again functional and having to do with the relationship between people and the city, once again, the reality of the city, I think, is absolutely crucial. And here I'm paying homage to Niko Sevisky once again, to look at the reality of the city, not only in terms of, well, we move away from Constantinople and Thessalonica because we were not Thessaloniki, because we were not the only one, but also because, I mean, the reality of the urban life in Byzantium has to do with the people living in the city. So Elisabetta Georgian, in particular, has investigated the flow of the Gortinian waters. So when I'm talking about Gortin, I'm always mentioning, deliberately making this example, I think it's also in the book, talking about the overflowing life. So it's using this metaphor of water, I'm encouraging people to see how the life overflowed the walls, I mean, went beyond the walls, because the investigation of the water supply infrastructure in Gortin has shown, and through the development of this, from a proper aqueduct to a series of fountains and cisterns, 6th to 7th and partially 8th century even, I mean, has shown how basically people, I mean, interacted and people lived the city. And you can see how you move from pipeline branching out to a foci of settlement centered around cisterns and fountains, which can tell you a lot about the social profile, socioeconomic profile of the city, because you mean most probably the control of those fountains and cisterns had a lot to do with local foci, once again, of settlements, which revolved around maybe ecclesiastical authorities or simply local elites. And so there you go. You have a kind of city, I mean, and also toying with this idea, city of islands, not because Gortin is in Crete on an island, not simply because that, but because you have this idea of different areas of settlement. And by investigating, continuing by investigating the flow of Gortinian waters, they realized that making the calculation of how much water was actually used by the population and how much water was instead let reach the countryside, the very rich countryside around it, you see how much, I mean, it's way more water it was captured from the sources, which were 25 kilometers away, if I'm not mistaken, from Gortin, brought to the city, obviously used to quench the thirst of the Gortinians, but a large amount of it was then, I mean, flew through the city into the countryside, which clearly fed. And there you don't even have walls. The only walls you can find in Gortin is, once again, second half of the 7th century, most probably, crowning the Acropolis. But you had several foci of settlements, which are documented by geographies even, and by archaeology, obviously, being built in the first half of the 8th century. Well, those areas were fed by these by cisterns, by fountains, but that water then was, I mean, flow into the countryside, and you'd have no wall separating those foci of settlements from the countryside. So there is a strict interaction there. And I'm lucky enough, and sorry, this is the very last point, then you can cut me off. And I'm lucky enough to live in a city which surprised me in this respect. Because, I mean, before coming to Ankara, where I live right now, I live in Istanbul, Ahmed, I told you before, and Istanbul, very dense. It's like Thessaloniki, Panos, more or less, or like Liverpool, guys, the same, Birmingham, okay? Occasionally, you can have a couple of parks in Birmingham, a golf club. But here, in Ankara, is very peculiar, because Ankara developed, I mean, it was an artificial capital, okay, once again, in the same line, in a little bit, in a sense, with Kivitas Novarakian. It was an artificial capital, you know better than me, created in 1920, after the war, and after the establishment of the Turkish Republic in 1923. So it developed from the area around the castle, which is the Byzantine castle, actually, which later on had Ottoman phase and so on and so forth. So it developed from that area it slowly with the migration of people who reach the capital, the embassies, and so on and so forth, and with the latest real estate developments. Well, anyway, developed, it turned into a city of 6 million people. So we are, but it's nothing like Istanbul. There is no, I mean, there are areas which were densely built, and then they have areas which have forest. I mean, there are not parks like Birmingham, something that has been constructed in a sense. These are really forests which have been kept by large areas. I mean, one is the campus of the Middle East Technical University. If you zoom it through Google Earth, you see it's a vast, enormous, humongous area which separate a quarter of a city from another quarter. So it's, once again, the forest in this very case, but we are not talking about the countryside, which is cultivated in a sense or used in any possible way, simply a huge chunk of forest, but there are others. It is not only this one. And so there is kind of this interaction between what we could have called as the countryside and what we can call a city. So Ankara in this respect makes you think a lot of this kind of development, which we could, this interaction that we could document. Then you can have the Eric Iveson, and this is the very, very, very last point. Sorry. Eric Iveson, who can, in going back to Gortin, who can tell you, well, there are city of islands because, I mean, we excavated only those islands and in between there is nothing. That's a good point. But I still, I mean, tend to believe that that model still old truth, even if, I mean, in other cities, it may not fully apply. In Thessaloniki, it doesn't apply. For instance, the city of island model, or up to a point, maybe yes, later on. But I mean, that's a good caveat and a good objection that we also have to keep in mind.
Luca, I need to ask you something
which is personal. I mean, I know, but we cannot go there.
It Thanos, is personal.
I mean, you say know? Something. I thought we said before we cannot go there. Sorry, let's just go.
No, it is personal. Actually, this question, it is, you know, it's personal because it has to do partially with my doctoral research. So we have the provinces, we have the capital, we have big cities. In the historiography, the historiographical sources, we have quite interesting opinions of how it is to live in a province, in a city, in a province. We have seen very weird descriptions of how it feels to live in Athens or in other provincial cities or towns. My question now is, what do we know about the relations between the big provincial cities and Constantinople? Obviously, especially before the 9th century, we have nice examples which are not indicative of the true relations. For example, I have Kherson in my mind. And what is the role of the elite, of the provincial elite in these relations, especially in the 9th century and after the 9th century, when we have a kind of new elite coming up?
That's a very good question, and not easy to answer. I mean, the focus, okay, let me put it this way. The focus of the Byzantine Empire, I think, became much more the Aegean, in a sense, because the loss of Sicily, on the one hand, brought, okay, other provinces may have stayed. I mean, Sardinia may have been part of this Byzantine kine, Dalmatia as well, a little bit. The Balearics most probably were lost forever in the beginning of the 10th century. So you have the role of the Aegean in economic terms became predominant in a sense. I mean, in ways that most probably it wasn't there before. Or to the fullest, I'm thinking of the trunk route that Michael McCormick has several times stressed, the existence of which, pardon, several stressed, linking the Tyrrhenian with the Aegean. Now it's much more Aegean oriented. Okay, Crete was lost, but then it was recovered in the mid of the 10th century, same for Cyprus. So in this respect, and you mentioned Kherson, which is true, but it's a place where, And I think Florin Curta was mentioning this in a recent online lecture of his. Something's not fully clear going on because you have Arjontes there, right, in charge of the city, and you don't fully understand how much the orders, if the orders were obviously coming from Constantinople, if they have a kind of leverage in a sense to act as we suspected, independently, as a sort of not only buffer but a sort of broker between the steppes and Byzantium, and Kherson was also at some point a mint, if I'm not mistaken. So I think in this respect, and you see that in terms of cities, the Aegean taking off, you can think of Thebes, you can think of Corinth, you can think of Athens itself up to a point, and so on and so forth. You can think of the change, that's very good, going back to Crete, change of the settlement pattern in Crete, where you have nothing to do with the Arabs, something which is already happening before the Andalusian pirates created or conquered Crete and created the Emirate. The change of the settlement pattern from the southern coast of the island, which used to be very important until the 8th century, to the northern coast of the island, the creation of Heraklion. That's highly indicative of the role of the Aegean as a kind of magnet, in a sense, in economy, as a network. And this is the work basically that Chris Wickham has brought to the attention of the public, and the Aegean becoming the sort of catalyst of the Byzantine Empire fully in the 10th and 11th century. So in this respect, when it comes to elites, is what I try to also to mention in the book, this kind of development of the local elites, not certainly along the lines that we experience or one can experience in the previous centuries, and for instance, the developing of mercantile elites, if you want. I'm thinking once again of the Archontes of Monemvasia, for instance, another example. Not everywhere, certainly, but Monemvasia is another example of a city in this respect. Cities which were not, for instance, thematic capital like Ephesus, which developed pilgrimage center, harbors, and this is the work, for instance, of Andreas Kultzer, which and others, which talk about the importance, the continuous importance of the Ephesian harbors, actually plural, even if the Roman harbor silted up. We thought it was the end of the city. That was not the case. It continued well into the 10th and 11th centuries, the work of Sabine Lastetter as well, and in terms of harbor and of Andreas Kultzer, among the others. So, commercial elites, the Archontes of Monemvasia were commercial elites, okay? Very strange one, very peculiar one, but you have, and with through Monemvasia, exactly, this kind of mercantile elites, and I think this is what Jonathan Shea, in his thesis, which has unfortunately never been published, has mentioned. I mean, through this, you can see how Byzantium, I mean, how certain cities of Byzantium could have developed in certain ways. I think is focusing his attention on Monemvasia, if I'm not mistaken, Ioannina, Arta, and a fourth one, which now I don't fully recollect. But the point that Jonathan Shea is making in his thesis is that, and he's using a lot of sigillographic material. This is for you, Gabriel. I'm sure you know about it. But, is that those cities could have developed along the lines of Italian mercantile cities. And the peculiarity of these Archontes in a Byzantine Empire, which was Aegean center, but also obviously retaining parts of Anatolia, in particular the western part, showed certain peculiarities, because I remember the what are they called? The Mavromates, if I'm not mistaken, family from Archontes, from Monemvasia, who ended up being the one of them being the father-in-law of the Seljuk Sultan and in charge of Nicaea when the Seljuk conquered Nicaea. So you see this, once again, moving away, veering away from Constantinople, which catches sometimes too much attention or caught the eyes, rightly so in a sense, but in terms of scholarly attention, you see this things going on, these ideas going on. You're absolutely right when you said, if you look at the provinces from the Constantinople point of view, I think you're, I mean, you were referring to Michael Koniates, right? The
exactly.
This famous passage on Athens, for instance, is all, this is backwards of the empire. This is terrible. What am I living in? I mean, this is, there is no class. To quote, I think, Joe Pesci, another movie, there is no class here, there is no class. But you see interesting things going on. I think certainly in terms, for instance, of commercial life and thriving commercial life, and in political terms, because as I said before, these Archontes in charge of Monemvasia or in charge of Kherson had ways of, I mean, navigating through the have certain abilities, which we can also find, for instance, in Cyprus, 10th century, the archbishop, I think his name was Demetrius, if I'm not mistaken, who was chosen, is the archbishop of Cyprus, was chosen as a member of diplomatic embassy to the caliph. So you see the abilities of these kind of peripheral elites, if you want to call them, being able to navigate through the interstices of provincial life, which is not necessarily as clear-cut as Constantinople wants to see. And this is, as I said before, commercial terms, economic term, political, if you want, with the Mavromates, Mavrozomates, I think, sorry, my bad. I will double-check. And the Archontes in Kherson. You see this, and this has been an article which has been published, I think, in 2013, something like that, which pushes this thing a little bit farther, this idea, for instance, of commercial elites, of the role of commercial elites, a little bit farther, and straight into the heart of Constantinople. I don't remember the author right now. I will tell you later on for sure, but she's interpreting the famous, but or maybe you are familiar with. She's interpreting the mosaic, the famous mosaic on the gallery, in the gallery of Hagia Sophia, the one with Constantine Monomachos, right? And Zoe, the princess Zoe, Constantine Monomachos has a pouch, right, in his hands, and Zoe had the scroll, which traditionally has been interpreted as a donation to the church and so on and so forth. Well, it's provocative and is highly debatable, the conclusion she came to, but the idea is that that was not obviously Monomachos, because the face has been replaced, was Romanos Argyros, and a representative of a new elite, commercial one, if you like. I don't like this label military elite because it's too easy. One like to go to also Caldelis, and Antonis Caldelis has worked on that, the role of the military elites, the Eastern frontier. That's one way in which the elites of Byzantium are changing, even though the idea of military elite has been, in a sense, revised. But nevertheless, this scholar, I will tell you the name later on, is basically saying, well, these commercial elites, in a sense, were starting or trying to get hold of political power through Romanos Argyros and through this pouch of money, which represent is the first instance, I think, I'm not an expert in the field, but she claims that, that this is a pouch of money, and money means obviously, I mean, commercial, or the fruits of commercial enterprises, of businesses. Okay, that what going back to the Justinianos Partikiakos I was mentioning before, clearly in the 9th century, in his will is calling this money laboratori solidi. If I'm not mistaken, in Latin is correct, laboratori solidi, which means solidi, I mean, the Byzantine gold coins, laboratori, laborare, right? Which made money made out of money. And that pouch would represent something like that and a push of the elite to claim the political power of Constantinople and later on most probably went nowhere. So it's possible to see this thing. I'm not an expert in nobility, in... I have a colleague here. I'm lucky enough to have Nathalie Edelman, who recently published a book on the 9th and 10th centuries of Hellenistic elites in the Byzantine Empire. So I'm not an expert in the field, but I think the scholars I mentioned, if we bring together their work, may have a point. And this is another thing that I really like when I teach what if, right? It's counterfactual history. I love counterfactual history. And actually, one of my students who is now PhD students who is now teaching one of those courses, general introductory courses, history of civilization. She's dedicating part of her classes, to push students into using her lectures in developing counterfactual scenarios. So it's very nice. I liked it, and I think she had a brilliant idea in this respect. What if, and this is what basically Jonathan Shea concludes in her thesis, what if the Ottomans hadn't taken Byzantium, or the Ottomans hadn't, in a sense, took over Western Anatolia, the Aegean, and so on and so forth? Maybe those cities would have developed on Evasia, Thebes, Ioannina, and so on and so forth, could have developed along Italian city-state lines, the Archontes in Kherson, the Archontes in Monevasia being a clear example of that. The very fact that Thebes and Chalcis, and this is the work of Nikos Kontoyiannis on this, worked as a kind of dynamic duo. One was the arbor of the other, funneling out the products of Thebes, commercial city, artisanal city, and you see a lot of ceramic. This is the way you also see things, right? Going back to seeing the reality of Byzantine cities. Sometimes you don't have urban fabric anymore. In Thebes, I think they excavated tanneries, if I'm not mistaken, or a couple of artisanal installations, but you don't have anything. You have the sources, the famous expedition of the Normans in the 12th century taking the silk, the silk production, the expert in silk production to Sicily. So you see through sources, you see little in archaeological terms, in terms of archaeology, but you see a lot in terms of material culture, the boom in ceramic production in the Aegean, right? 12th, 13th century, Ioannita Rum, and many others have studied this, the ceramic, which basically boomed in the Aegean in the 12th and 13th century. So another way of seeing this commercial elite booming, in a sense. So what if Fourth Crusade first, and above all the arrival of the Ottomans, hadn't happened? Because the Fourth Crusade didn't disturb the provincial cities, right? That's another great real issue. I mean, big deal for Constantinople, but okay, most probably a little bit of a deal for Thessaloniki, but in the rest of the empire, I mean, you have cities which basically actually Bistra thrive because of this. So you have not a real disruption in the way that Constantinople was disrupted. But that's another story.
So I have a question that has to do with the terminology that today we talk about Byzantine city in general. But is there any difference in the way that they called the cities, Castron, Polis, and has to do with the ideology of creating one, such as Mistra and Thessaloniki, are the same in terms of ideology, or maybe the factions that they serve?
Well, terminology should be taken into consideration, right? Duly taken into consideration. But terminology cannot be the only indicator of the changes. I mean, we know that the Byzantine sources, you guys and Panos, you in particular, know that Byzantine sources lie. I mean, I hate to quote house and here, but it's true, everybody lies. And in particular, the Byzantine sources, so for different reasons, right? I mean, this, and I think there is, Elena Saradi had done a wonderful job in sifting through the geographies and see how much the changes in terminology had to do with the way you want to port Byzantine saints to be portrayed. So there is a clear difference between the three periods, in a sense, she divided into three periods, early, middle, and late Byzantine era. So it's true, there is, and in the work of John Holden, the work of Kasdan as well, in his article about terminology, about custom, it's true, there is a certain, and it's in, you cannot deny it, it's undeniable, that there is an importance of military functions, okay, for certain cities. Is absolutely right, thematic capital and so on and so forth. For instance, I'm simplifying here. But it's also true that certain areas of the empire militarized lay way later than others. And I'm thinking about islands, so I'm going back to islands at some point. So this has to be taken into consideration that, for instance, provinces which we tend to regard as peripheral and they were not what we tend to regard as the frontier of the empire, the military outpost of the empire, both in terms of local aristocracies and in terms of urban profile, they didn't militarize until much, much later than Anatolia, for instance, or there are certain areas that militarize, and this is the work of Archidan in the Balkans, militarize a little bit earlier than others or experience a kind of retrenchment of urban life earlier than Anatolia. So I think it's important to look at this aspect instead of trying to find a one-size-fits-all model based upon terminology. Okay, and what does castron mean? I mean, once again, castron is more a way of saying as castralization, right? We are sheltering behind these small walls, often built in hastily built, I was saying before, sometimes actually built with whatever we find, spolia, right? And I think, going back to this, we have to be careful. There is a recent article by John Holden which came out, which documented the stages of this castralization process in Anatolia. Is not true that they are immediately built thematic capitals. Oh, we built up the walls and everybody's behind those walls because those cities only matter. Is not true. There is a progress from strategia to themes from the 8th to the 9th century, and is linking this to the urban development of the singling out of certain cities as more important than others in administrative terms, but certainly not simply defined by the very fact that fortifications were built. And in the very case, I'm sorry, I'm going back to Ankara because I mean, you live in Ankara, you tend to, and not far away from Amorion, by the way, which is one of the best excavated Byzantine sites. It's 2 hours away. So when you visited me, guys, I mean, we all go to Amorion because it's a place certainly that is worth visiting. Today it used to be excavated by Eric Iveson, Martin Harrison, then Chris Lightfoot, then Eric Iveson, Nico Siviskis, and now it's Elia De Virago Kalp in charge of the excavation. They are always very welcoming. If you live in Ankara and you live in places like Amorion, yes, they are thematic capital, I can understand. But if you look in Ankara in particular at the sheer extension of what is called in Turkish today, Gavril, Kale, right? Which in Turkish means castle. This is huge. This is not something that, ooh. And a student working on this, the role of spolia here, which is prominent, visually prominent, you see these walls, these walls which encircle the former Acropolis of the city, of the Roman city. Well, it's a huge space, and these walls which built with spolia, and the spolia were not simple. Oh, okay, they have pragmatic function, but they also have ideology. Going back to the work of Nikos Bakirtis, among the others on Thessaloniki and others on the walls of Thessaloniki, these spolia are meant to highlight certain parts of the city, of the citadel, Okay. And this is the great thing, not only in relationship with what is inside the city. It's too obvious to exalt like the Golden Gate of Constantinople, the entrance, the main entrance to the castle. Great. That's very obvious. But they are also in a dialogue with the urban structure and the spaces which are facing those walls. Okay. In Ankara is a little bit less visible because they built a lot recently, so the walls are now suffocated by. But you see this in Nicaea, for instance. This is a comparison that can be done in Nicaea, another city prominently defined by its walls, okay, which, by the way, this time they don't even encircle a shrunk in size city. The city retained the same dimension as the late antique city with the same orthogonal grid. And by the way, this orthogonal grid can be documented in Gortyn in the 8th century, in Kherson in the 8th century, in Naples in the 8th century, in Syracuse 8th and 9th century. So it's more common than we can think. It's not only Nicaea, but the tower of the wall of Nicaea, which has been strengthened up with spolia by Alexios I Komnenos, use as spolia Arabic tombstones with Arabic inscriptions, which you say, okay, whatever. Not true, because those tombstones are coming from a cemetery, which was obviously a cemetery of Arabic people. Why they were there, we have no idea. Were they simply prisoner of war, slaves? So there was a community like in Constantinople. There was an Arabic community. Well, anyway, like in Cyprus, there was one. Nicholas Mystikos is talking about that. Anyway, this reuse of spolia on that particular tower facing the Arab cemetery is meant to signify something, is meant to create a dialogue, this time a kind of triumphal dialogue between that space of the outside of the city and that part of the wall. In Ankara, Ufuk Serin has documented the same kind of thing, most probably with the church, one of the most important churches built in the 9th century, St. Clement's, which was the most important pilgrimage site outside the walls of Ankara, so not inside the castle. And part is true that it's possible that part of those of the spolia which were used embedded in the city walls, in that particular area of the city walls, are in dialogue with that church. So in terms of specialities, the work of Mirto Veco has done a wonderful work in this respect with the mosque in Manisa, has been published in the proceedings of the fourth Sevgigonul Symposium. This kind of use of spolia to highlight certain parts of a building or certain parts of a wall in terms of specialty can be documented for single buildings, like a mosque in this case is one of the beyliks, the Turkish beyliks mosques in Manisa, if I'm not mistaken, and can be seen on walls. And that leads us to also, once again, another talking about ideology, it leads us to think of the role of spolia as to hint at the past of the city. And that's totally deliberate, because in Ankara in particular, because we know that the wall of Ankara has been rebuilt by Michael III. There are inscriptions of him celebrating Michael III as the Ktitor, the founder. Panos, correct me if I'm wrong, and Gabriel, your Greek is way better than mine. But you're Italian, isn't it? Just joking. We know that the walls of Ankara has been at some point rebuilt after the famous incursion of the Arabs, 838. They destroyed Amorion. They deliberately Amorion. It was the birthplace of the Michael III's dynasty, the Amorian dynasty. Anyway, Amorion was destroyed in 838. Ankara as well. Michael III rebuilt both. There's an inscription on the walls of Ankara. Well, a lot of spolia at that point were embedded in certain part of the city walls to deliberately hint at this role of Michael III as refounded of the ancient Ankara, okay, the Ankara that the Roman Ancyra, which boasted the famous temple of Augustus with the res gestae inscribed on, and you can still see them in what is left of the temple of Augustus, which, by the way, is outside once again the city walls, and most probably was also turned into a monastery in, again, the 9th century. So the relationship between the castle and what is outside the city. So we have, in other words, to be careful when we talk about Asti, is I think I pronounce it correctly in Greece, or Castra, or cities. When we deal with the sources, because we, with literary sources, because I mean we know that they can lie, they know that they are using certain type of terminology because they are the Greek, because of their models, their rhetoric, and so on and so forth, because in terms of a geography, going back to Elena Saradi's work, because they want to exalt certain role of the saints, or the importance of saints in different ways. But also when it comes to archaeology, it's not only the words that lie, but also objects which can, in a sense, deceive us. And we tend to believe, for instance, that spolia, we put them there because we don't know. No, there is a deliberate use of spolia, which has once again a superfetation, a palimpsest of meaning, which we need to take into due consideration. And going back to the work before along inscriptions, and there is also a certain aesthetic, involved that we certainly cannot fully grasp. Those spolia, that especially for Ankara, but also for Nicaea, this alternation between certain white marbles and ashlar blocks, it creates a certain, there is an intent to make certainly the walls less monotonous or less dull, in the same way as later on in the 11th and 12th century, right? They decorated with bricks, they built the walls of ecclesiastical buildings. I'm thinking of Daphne and others with these beautiful patterns, brick patterns, and so on and so forth. You know this thing better than me. So there is a lot that more than it meets the eye, That's, I think that's the right word. So terminology, I think, should be weaved into all this sort of thing. And this is interdisciplinary. I think you both guys are mastering this interdisciplinarity way better than me.
And I think, just to build up a bit, and I think at least the inscriptions and the study of epigraphy, even though it still, and very sadly in our field, is still quite embryonic, has to add much in, at least in the terminology. We have great studies from, Azdraka, Sofia Kalopisi-Verti, and more, and even master thesis in Greece, also doctoral thesis. That has to add much in this discussion, and hopefully in the future we'll see more.
No, it's true, and I think Ida, which who published a handbook of Byzantine epigraphy, so that kind of work on epigraphy, as you were saying, could be zoomed out, in a sense, from the inscription and so on and so forth, and related to cities and the role of walls, as blackboards. That's what Nikos Bakirtis is mentioning in his work on Thessaloniki, literally blackboards of the life of what was going on in the city. Not simply in terms of, they refounded, or they decided to rebuild or sponsor the rebuilding of a certain structure of the world, but simply as going back to aristocracies, telling us what was going, what aristocracies thought, or what aristocracies were doing in the city, the kind of messages that they want to pass and to pound, in a sense, upon the local people. The position of certain inscription is strategic. It's not simply, we put him there because not the certain, and in Thessaloniki you have them, right, in the passage from the lower city to the citadel.
Anopoli.
The Anopoli, thanks. Certain inscriptions are strategically positioned to to be seen and to pass a certain type of message, or in a sense to let the, I mean, to let the people know about the importance of certain members of the aristocracy, local aristocracy, who had a certain type of agenda, mostly imperial, obviously, in places like Thessaloniki and or Ankara, where you have this kind of inscription, literally you cannot miss it because you bump into it before entering the bent gate, which give entrance to the inner castle. I mean, it's there, you cannot miss it. It's super visible. So it's meant to be seen when you enter. In this case, it's obviously the emperor telling certain things, but in Thessaloniki you have this kind of local aristocracy also playing competing against each other. So I fully agree this idea of getting the epigraphy more into the picture in this respect. To complete what you were saying, there is also, and you are absolutely right, in terms of there is also a visuality, pardon, of city walls that with San Demetrius is pretty obvious in Crete, right? And with the mosaic, the background is the walls, right? The famous mosaic with the San Demetrius embracing the, yes, the archbishop. So the city walls and this apotropaic role of walls, because there are the cross, being put there. And even this is something that, again, I'm working a lot with Nikos Bakirtis, who is a friend and also a great scholar, and he taught me a lot. He also identified the reuse of certain, and I've seen this in Ankara. He was referring to places like Serres and like Thessaloniki, indeed. But I found it in Ankara, is the way that they reuse Roman or part of Roman statues or Roman engravings with a full or a half a bust, in a sense, figure, and they put it in the wall to, on top of the, far away from the viewer, so very high, on the facade of those walls to act as icons. That's extremely fascinating. Extremely, in the same way as San Demetrius is there with the walls, you have those spolia acting as icons to protect. So apotropaic, not only the cross, which is pretty obvious, but also icons. So there is also this aspect, the apotropaic function, the sanctification of the city, of the pomerium, right, of the city, which has always been holy from the time of Romulus, when he ploughed the first sacred pomerium, was called, right, the ascent. Sorry, Panos, you were saying?
Yes, I think that in order to understand the creation or how the city, a city, evolves through the time, all the changes that happen socially from too many threats that are in the region, such as Thessaloniki and Macedonia, or even in Turkey, Istanbul, and etc. We have to have in mind all these factors that make a city live, evolve, and protect also the society and the city itself from any threat of the region. And to help our listeners to understand the Byzantine city in general, I think that we have talked about Castron, Thessaloniki, Constantinople, Crete, and many other places, but we haven't spoken about the islands or the difference between islands and cities like Thessaloniki and Constantinople. Is there any difference in these cities, islands and mainland?
Certainly, there is a difference in terms of, I don't like to use this word, and I'm using it with 3,600 pinch of salt, like the Turkish guy that put the salt there. Okay, Salt Bay, whatever it's called. Continuity. Okay, there is a lot, but not for the sake of it, but simply because I was mentioning before, and this is the work of Cosentino as well as proved that, islands, large islands. Here we have to first and foremost talk which islands, because not every island is an island. Yes, it is. But I'm talking about large islands. Obviously, there is a theorization in insular studies now that separates archipelago from islands. So there is this kind of theorization, is people like Baldacchino have done it, not to do with Byzantine studies, but with insular studies, which theorize the difference between large islands and archipelagos. But that's a complete difference. So the Aegean, you can regard them as a bunch of archipelagos, whereas we are talking about big islands. Then, I mean, size matters. And I'm not saying anything that Gavril does not know about. So I'm talking about Cyprus, I'm talking about Rhodes, I'm talking about Crete, I'm talking, even if Rhodes also is a little bit debatable, let's for the sake of it, I'm talking about Crete, I'm talking about Sicily, I'm talking about Malta, I'm talking about Sardinia, and I'm talking about the Balearics. So it's a corridor in a sense. That's how it has been described. Now, a corridor island by Salvatore Cosentino. Now, the problem with these islands is that they have been regarded, when I start working on islands, because I was in Cyprus, what else can you possibly do if not work on island and on Cyprus back then? And then I started expanding my, broadening my horizon to other islands. The first thing that they were seen, they were regarded as big islands, as peripheral. I mean, maybe Crete was an exception because more or less part of the Aegean, but certainly peripheral, okay? Military outpost at the frontier, whatever the frontier means, and so on and so forth, okay? To the point that certain islands were not even regarded as part of the Byzantine Empire. Crete and Cyprus, certainly, yes. Lost in the second half of the 7th century until 965. Crete lost for 150 years. More or less, and that's it. That's the attention that the islands got, but both regarded as frontier, military outposts. The word of Lungis, for instance, is in this respect very relevant. Malamute as well, Elizabeth Malamute. Then Sicily was included much more into the picture, partially because, I mean, we realized the importance that he had as the granary of the empire after Egypt fell, and partially because archaeology came much more into the picture. So from the Eastern Mediterranean, we slowly acknowledged that Sicily was an important part of the Byzantine Empire. But still, I mean, at the best you can hope for, like you and Morrison were doing that, attach it to the Byzantine Earthland, like Chris Wickham defined Aegean and Anatolia in his Framing the Early Middle Ages. So, and that's it, in a sense. Then Sicily was lost. 878, Syracuse, the capital, fell. That's it, finish. Okay, very easy. Very easy, easy piece, that's the way. But, I mean, it's not necessarily, that was not the case. And what we have realized that those islands, that corridor, as is Cosentino defined it, retain economic, much more economic vitality than the Earthland until, well, in the 9th century. It was a less militarized place, with the exception, partial exception of Sicily, but the other islands, for instance, Sicily became a theme. The other islands never became a theme, going back to the Archontate that we were mentioning. Whatever Archontate or Ducates meant, certainly, they were not military. There is not a development of a military aristocracy in the way that you see, for instance, in Constantinople and in Anatolia in the 7th or 8th century. There is not this kind of militarization. And there is a deliberate attempt of the Byzantine Empire not only to retain those islands, but to link those islands. And that was the third step, in a sense, because it would be easy then to historiographically to say, and they did, and it has been done up to a point, but Enrico Zanini, Philippe Pergolai, and Dimitris Michaelidis, when they edited this book called The Insular System of Byzantium, to say, well, okay, then let's englobate this corridor into another big chunk, okay, of a third pillar, in a sense, of the Byzantine Empire, Anatolia, Aegean, and the islands. That's it. All the islands are the same. Not true. Not even that. Is true, and islands developed in a different way. So what happened in Sardinia, in Balearics, in Malta, is obviously different than what's going on in Sicily and Crete. But let's forget that there because we were talking about cities. Well, anyway, the very fact that there is an attempt to, on the part of the Byzantine Empire, to weave this insular world into a kind of what has been described by Paul Arthur, among the others, as Byzantine kine, as a collection of coastal and insular spaces, which boasted gateway communities, harbors, or real cities. I mean, real, much more prominent urban sites. I mean, I'm not sure important. So a kind of a hierarchy of settlement, which we can see in action and linked together by a material culture. Because this is the point. We see a deliberate attempt of the state through material culture. I'm going to talk about ovoidal amphora, global amphora, seals, coins, and so on and so forth. A deliberate attempt on the part of the Constantinople to keep those insular and coastal spaces, this kine, together, and the material culture is the best way of seeing that. Well, this has allowed us to see how urban life in those on those islands, because of this kind of economic vitality, less militarization, and so on and so forth, developed not necessarily along the lines that we experience, for instance, in Anatolia or elsewhere. So places like Gorti, for instance, places which is one of the best excavated sites, and places like Catania, Syracuse, Palermo, Cagliari, Olbia. Olbia is a great example, for instance. It's on the northeastern coast of Sardinia, and it was an important harbor for in the Roman period. Then we thought, well, the Visigoth came. Goodbye, the thing is over. The Vandals came, and it was game over for that harbor. It's not true. They managed to find, through an analysis of shipwrecks, we realized that that harbor remained very frequented until later. I mean, so part of this Byzantine Q&A, places like not on islands, but places like Butrint, for instance, places like Zadar in Croatia, places like Venice, Rialto, okay? So Comacchio, this is another fantastic example of how, I was mentioning before, Comacchio is not far away, north of Ravenna, okay? And it's an emporium. I was saying that before. It's an emporium, and it's a real example of new city, completely not built from a previous existing settlement, 8th and 9th century, developing along the lines of emporia, so purely commercial, living, thriving, and prospering on this kind of brokerage between the Byzantine network, economic network, with the Carolingian network. So you see cities like that, and you don't see Comacchio anywhere else. Okay, it's not fully a Byzantine city, but it has a certain, its political life and its social life, and the aristocracy certainly look also at Byzantium. Material culture is definitely Byzantine, or at least partially Byzantine. So you see these kind of trends that you don't see elsewhere. And it's not by chance that street grid, which was, we saw in Nicaea, we can document in Nicaea, we can find that street grid being retained in cities like Kherson, which was part of that Quine, Syracuse, which was part of that Quine on an island, Kherson coastal, Syracuse on an island, okay, Gortin, which was on the capital of Crete, Salamis, Constantia, the capital of Cyprus, where they, I mean, obviously Cyprus is a big deal. There has not been excavation taking place in the northern half of the island since 1972. But you can see that the street grid, the orthogonal street grid in Salamis was respected, in particular the Decumanos leading to the harbor, which remained frequented in the 8th century. So also there you have the street grid in place. And you have once again this dialogue between the walled area and, in this very case, the harbor. So this is the reason, sorry, Panos, for the long answer, but this is the reason why certain trends, being highly innovative, like Comacchio up to a point, Civitas Nova Heracleana, or simply showing much more continuity with the, in terms of palimpsest, once again, with the late antique cities, can be visible on islands, because islands develop or follow certain trajectories politically, economically, in military terms, well into the 9th century, and retain much more vitality in each one of these aspects, if you want. And urbanism is, in a certain way, reflecting, right, what's going on in the region at large. And this is why you can maybe see it a little bit better. Then, once again, I was telling before, Crete changed the settlement pattern already. Cyprus is a big question mark. I mean, with Nikos Bakirtis, we didn't theorize at some point that for a while it was an island with no capital. Okay, with Salamis, Constantia retained certain function of a capital, but the other functions were, in a sense, moved elsewhere and scattered a bit along the northern coast. So it's interesting to see this sort of continuity, vitality, resilience. That's the word better to use rather than continuity. Resilience, which lasted into the 9th century and could be reflected into urbanism. Then Gabriel can tell me, well, but is it, and what after the 9th century? Well, Gabriel is absolutely right, as often happens, that you see the certain trends, which actually the trends you can document in Anatolia and elsewhere, with these kind of walls being built, new ways of devising cities in much more with the military function or the protective function, much more being given the pride of place, being implemented in particular in Sicily as well, with the creation of proper, in these fortresses. I'm thinking about Ragusa, I'm thinking about Enna, I'm thinking about Butera, to protect the main capital, which was, or actually to protect the urban settlement on the east coast, in particular Syracuse, the capital. So you see the development of an internal frontier. That's obviously what happened in Sicily because of the Aglabid invasion. But you see these trends. But to go back to this point, you see certain trends developing because islands were much more resilient spaces as part of this koiné, well into the ninth century.
Thank you very much, Luca, for that. And we don't have much time left, but I have to say now for our listeners that if they enjoyed the conversation and they want to learn more, most of the things we talked about have been published by you. First of all, in your big volume, which you published in 2021, if I'm not wrong, The Byzantine City from Heraclius to the Fourth Crusade, 610 to 1204, published by Palgrave Macmillan. And your very recent article in the DO, the Bartolong Papers, A Lost World That Never Died. Now, I would like to ask you, because I know you've told us, of course, I don't have like secret undisclosed information. I would like to ask you, what's next for you?
My next project is, actually, has been recently completed. The manuscript has been finally delivered to Routledge. Is a book that has been commissioned to Nikos Bakirtis and myself. Is the Routledge Companion to Byzantine Cities. Is coming out by the end of the year. That's what Routledge at least said. It should be, at least in the electronic version. So that's job done. But the next big project, which is basically the conclusion of this long journey, which started in 2008, in when I set foot on 2008, yes, September, when I set foot on Cyprus, is a book which is under contract with IRC, a book on Byzantine, large Byzantine islands, which, if everything goes fine, it will be published. It will complete in 2024 and most probably coming out in 2025, if not by the end of 2024. So that's how the two, but, I mean, a project which has been, which has recently come to an end. And I have to say it was very, very nice project, because, I mean, one of the things that I like is to, whenever I have the opportunity to work in a team and to work with people I regard first as friends and then as great colleagues and great source of inspirations. So inspiration. So in the edited volume, there are 20 contributors. I was lucky enough to have people I really admire, whose work I really admire, and were a very good friend, from Mirto Veiku to Maria Cristina Carile, to Enrico Cirelli, to Elisabetta Giorgi, and many, many others. Jan Randall is a great expert on material culture on the maritime frontier. So I'm forgetting Elena Saradi as well. So and Michael Dacre among the others. So those all are great scholars, fantastic scholars, but also good friends. And it was enormous fun, and I learned a lot, and it was great to have them as part of this project. So this is a kind of something that I would like to do again, maybe in the future, in a different format. My one thing that I like to do, I mean, under the auspices of this once again joint effort with local with colleagues from Ankara, in particular Serjan Yandem, who teaches at the GTP, has always been of huge help and support. It's called Byzantium at Ankara. We have a website on this, and we organize online, mostly, unfortunately, conferences or seminars, workshops or seminars. Well, under the auspices of Byzantium and Ankara, we had recently a workshop in which called Zooming in Byzantine Cities, in which we brought scholars working on cities, on different aspects of urbanism in the interdisciplinary perspective, in a dialogue with one another. And it was a great fun, because all of them mostly know each other or each other work. So I would love to do something and publish something along those lines, because I think working together with great scholars and friends, as you said, brings up all the passion, all the ideas, and it's huge fun and is hugely benefit, and it's not the same, the usual format, right? And you are invited, obviously, both panels are already invited, but Gabriel, you are both most welcome to virtually come to give us talks to students and to the enthusiasts, local enthusiasts, and to the scholars indeed, here. Indeed. So we have to work on this.
We should. Thanks a lot, Luca. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. We really appreciate it that you accepted our invitation and you came to our podcast. You know, we tried many times to actually arrange this recording. We finally made it, and we're glad, especially after our meeting, you know, in Birmingham when we first met.
Oh, thank you, guys. I think, I mean, when we met in Birmingham, it's a fantastic thing that you are doing. Big fan.
Thanks a lot. Thank you very much. We're looking forward to reading your next work. We wish you all the best. Thanks a lot, Luca.
Same to you, guys.
Ευχαριστούμε το ιστολόγιο Ανασκαφή για την αναδημοσίευση των επεισοδίων μας.